Occupational licensing is very unique, and in terms of presidential campaigns and U.S. presidents, there's only one U.S. president that has been both a union member and has had an occupational license. Can you name that president?
I'm going to take a stab in the dark and say Jimmy Carter.
No, he was a peanut farmer, and he was neither in a license or in a union, but fairly recent.
Maybe there's a peanut farmer's union.
Now, Ronald Reagan was a member of a union. In fact, he was president of the Screen Actors Guild.
Oh.
But he was never licensed. Donald Trump is the only U.S. president who has been both licensed and a union member. He was a licensed real estate agent in New York, and he is a member, in fact, gets a pension from the Screen Actors Guild. So he had to join the Screen Actors Guild, which is a union. So as far as I know, he's the only president who, as part of their job, was both licensed and was a union member.
This is Civios, your source for public affairs research, a podcast from the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota.
Hello, welcome again to Civios, a podcast initiative from the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota. I am Emma Welter, the Digital Communications Manager, and today I am here with Professor Morris Kleiner, who I read earlier this week described as the godfather of occupational licensing. So I'm very honored to be in his presence. Hello.
Well, hello, and thank you for having me back again with that introduction. I'm sure my mother would have been very proud, and my father may have believed it. So thank you.
So this is somewhat of a follow-up to a podcast that you recorded with Civios in 2017, but obviously a lot has changed since then because we are 7 months into a global pandemic. You're teaching a class this fall that deals with the influence of COVID-19 on occupational licensing. Would you like to talk a little bit about that? How's it going?
Well, really well. Thank you again for the opportunity to talk to Civios and be part of Civios. The class that I'm teaching really deals with the impact of the pandemic on the labor force and some of the major changes it's had. And the class includes a number of students from all around the university, and we've been fortunate to have a number of guests like Michael Osterholm, who may be the world's leading expert on epidemiology and pandemics. And I also have an appointment at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis and have worked with the Federal Reserve Board for over 15 years. And we've been able to get a number of people to the class who focus their research on seeing the effect of the pandemic on the economy and the labor force. And there have been some very dramatic changes in the labor force as a consequence of the pandemic.
Have you been doing any research with the students from that class?
Yes, we're doing work on a number of issues, including income inequality, some of the changes that have happened as a in business. For example, there's been a decline in the number of small businesses and significant growth in large businesses. So companies like Walmart, Costco have grown as a result of the pandemic, where small ma and pa operations have had a very difficult time and are really struggling as a consequence.
Do you plan on teaching this course in the months to follow, in the next semester, just as the pandemic continues, or is this a one-off?
Well, it would depend on what both the short and the long-term effects of the pandemic are. So in the short run, for example, people who can are staying home, but they're working more hours. So that's been sort of an interesting result. And there's also been some very significant effects in the labor force, and not necessarily good ones. Individuals who can teach from home, such as college professors, have been able to adapt, but individuals who work in the entertainment area, who deal with transportation, have really had a very difficult time and have lost wages and jobs as a result of the pandemic.
I'm sure it's both validating and depressing to see that all of these things coming out in the news are reflecting research that you've done for decades, because you've been at the Humphrey School for over 3 decades, I believe. And there was an article that came out in Forbes this week that showed that a lot of your research is being reflected in this new tool that came out, I think, from George Mason University. They created a new tool that tracks occupational licensing across states. Is that correct?
Right. And we there are a number of different databases, including one that we've developed here at the University of Minnesota at the Minnesota Population Center, which tracks occupational licensing over time and across states. And we're using that to see what effect occupational licensing, which is defined as you need permission from government in order to work. And that is a process that's grown dramatically. So, for example, in the 1950s, only about 5% of the workforce required permission from government in order to do your work. And now that number is somewhere between 1 in 4 and 1 in 5 workers require that as a condition of work.
I find that really interesting because so many occupations now didn't exist in the 50s. Like me being a digital communications manager, that would have been complete gibberish to somebody then. And obviously I don't need a license to work, but how does that even get determined?
A lot of the growth in licensing is through new occupations, but also, for example, dental hygienists, respiratory therapists, and many other occupations really didn't exist or were spin-offs of existing occupations. So individuals who were legal assistants now are licensed in many states, and those occupations didn't exist in the 1950s or were certainly not licensed. So many occupations have become licensed. In fact, there are now over 800 occupations that are licensed in at least one state, and occupational licensing, at least in the U.S., tends to be a state-by-state process. There's been both a growth in the number of occupations that require permission from government in order to work, and there's been an expansion of the service sector where most of the occupations who are licensed exist. Both of that has resulted in a multiple growth, that is from 5% to 20 to 25% of all individuals must have a license in order to work.
I guess that makes your research ever growing as well, because you're just tracking so many new occupations. One of the occupations that I know you've done a lot of work on recently is healthcare, and I think that is influenced so much by COVID-19, obviously. Would you like to talk a little bit about how you believe that COVID has influenced healthcare workers?
Yeah, it's been fairly dramatic. So just to give you an illustration some narrative to what's happened, there's been work done by individuals who are largely COVID chasers, sort of like tornado chasers. And one individual, Trinity Goodman, was a nurse in New York when the pandemic was spiked in New York. And she's been going around the country along with a whole cadre of nurses who are going to wherever there's a hot spot. So they moved to Texas and they moved to Florida. To where COVID is really spiked. And that's really has been an intersection of licensing, because Many states allow individuals to move to that state without seeking permission. So, for example, Arizona, Montana, and a number of other states have allowed individuals from other states to come there and practice. Or there have been provisional licenses issued to especially individuals who are nurses and respiratory therapists who have really borne the brunt of the spikes that have occurred as a result of the pandemic. But one of the issues is that licensing has really served as sand in the grease of the labor market, sand rather than grease in the labor market. So it's been much harder for people to move across states and in the case of COVID, take care of patients because states have not been able to ramp up not only physical capital like respirators, but also human capital. So individuals who have COVID have not been able to be taken care of because there just haven't been enough workers where there have been these spikes in COVID cases. And that's it's really hard. These people have PTSD from doing that because they go and they went from New York to Texas to Florida to Arizona, and you're dealing with especially initially a lot of death.
It's just a constant struggle.
One of the stories I tell in my class is that when I got my bachelor's degree, I thought I knew everything, and when I got my master's degree, I thought I knew nothing. And when I got my PhD, I thought nobody knows anything. And when we're dealing with the pandemic, I think everyone has a PhD because nobody knows what's going on.
I'm really interested in the concept of COVID chasers because how does that work on a practical and a logistical level? So for Trinity, is she having to, in advance, prior to going to a new state, does she have to check with the licensing board of that state to make sure that she's eligible to work there? Or does she move there and then retroactively all of those provisions are made?
It depends on the state, since licensing in the U.S. is very state dependent. So, for example, Minnesota is not part of the Nurses Compact.
Oh.
And a Nurses Compact, there are 36 states where nurses can move from state to state and they're immediately licensed. But in Minnesota, if you come from another state, you have to meet the statewide requirements. And for when Minnesota and Minneapolis was a hotspot for the pandemic, the governor had to give provisional licensing permission for especially individuals who are respiratory therapists or nurses to work in the state because they were not licensed. So that slowed things down.
Right.
So the ability of healthcare workers in order to expand the capacity of people and the healthcare system to deal with patients took a lot longer in a state like Minnesota than those states that are part of the compact.
That sounds like such a confusing, tangled web that's always changing. Because if they make a provision in one state, will they need to extend it kind of based on how things are going?
That's exactly what's happening because a lot of the provisional licenses are expiring. So typically they would be 60 or at most 90 days. And a lot of these people who are the pandemic chasers going around the country for the hotspots, their provisional certificates will have expired.
Oh, wow.
Also in Colorado, which also relaxed its licensing restrictions, individuals who had just graduated as a respiratory therapist or as a nurse were given immediate licensing. Typically, they would have to do an apprenticeship or pass a test, and that would take many months. But given that Denver was at one point a hotspot in terms of COVID, these individuals were given immediate licenses upon graduation. In addition, individuals who had let their licenses expire because they were retiring or they moved into other areas were immediately allowed to practice even though they had not kept their licenses up because of the huge spike in demand for individuals to take care of patients. So it's not just hospital capacity or respirators. It's the human capital of individuals to deal with COVID patients that is really important. And occupational licensing plays a really important role in the healthcare system's ability to deal with capacity.
Do you feel like it's sustainable to have these current provisions and current licensing regulations, or do you feel like there will have to be a shift?
Well, in order to deal with the current crisis, states have adapted. So they've, in many cases, as I've mentioned, relaxed the licensing provisions in order to allow new healthcare workers to enter immediately and for senior individuals to come back. And it's had a really big effect. States like Colorado have been able to dramatically increase by 10 to 15% their healthcare capacity in terms of dealing with COVID patients. The future is uncertain. That is, are all states going to keep these provisions? That is, allowing individuals who graduate from and are respiratory therapists to practice immediately, or to have other individuals join. That's to be determined, but at least in the short run, and I view this as sort of battlefield commissions, individuals are given licenses in order to deal with the crisis at hand.
Why is it that this is determined on a state and not a federal level?
It goes back to a number of Supreme Court case decisions in the 1880s.
Oh, okay.
That really devolved occupational licensing and made it a state issue. So now over 75% of all licenses are determined at the state level. And there are some local agencies that provide licenses at the city or county level, and there are federal licenses, but the dominant form of occupational licensing in the U.S. is at the state level.
So 3 years ago in 2017, you mentioned that you had been working with Jana Johnson, an assistant professor here at the Humphrey School, on the effects of occupational licensing on interstate migration. Have you seen continued results from that research?
Yes, fortunately, the work that I have done with Professor Johnson has had some significant effects. For example, the state of Arizona used some of our research to last summer. It was about a year ago, in fact, change their licensing provisions to allow anyone from any other state to move to Arizona, and they would immediately accept their licensing provisions and allow them to practice immediately. And they were the first state to do that. Now, since then, a number of other states have followed the Arizona model in allowing people who come to that state who are licensed in another state to allow them to practice immediately. And our research, the work that I did with Professor Johnson, was used and cited as a way to increase mobility and make the labor market more efficient and more responsive, as well as dynamic in terms of its ability to serve consumers.
That is great news. I know you also have testified in a number of hearings, I think with the Senate recently. Has that influenced your work on COVID or vice versa?
Well, that work occurred well before the pandemic, but my expertise has been used in both congressional hearings in both the House and Senate, and I've been to the White House at least a half a dozen times in both Republican and Democratic administrations to provide advice on ways to reduce some of the negative consequences, potentially negative consequences, of occupational licensing. And in just as an aside, First Lady Michelle Obama was very concerned about the ability of individuals who were in the military to be able to move across state lines. And there was one case where someone was in North Carolina and they were moving to California, and the trailing spouse was a teacher. And she was working as a teacher in North Carolina, but when she moved to California, she couldn't get a license for about 2 years. And the family, the soldier and their family had to go on food stamps.
Ugh.
So Michelle Obama and Jill Biden, who also wrote a report on this issue, became very concerned and moved the issue of occupational licensing from the back burner to the front burner as being an important issue for the U.S. military in terms of their ability to move people from around the states. And it's also been very important in terms of individuals who may want to transition from the military to the civilian sector, that is, training they've received, for example, as a medic in the military. They would not receive any credit if they wanted to become an EMT in the civilian sector. And there's been a dramatic movement of states to allow individuals to move from the military sector to the civilian sector. And that has been a real benefit, especially for individuals who are transitioning from the military to the civilian sector.
And that has been supported in part by your research.
That's correct. A lot of the work that's been going on, not just me, but we've had, I've worked with a number of PhD students. In fact, I'm currently supporting through grants three PhD students who are developing work on the origins and evolution of occupational licensing and how occupational licensing influences both individuals who are going into licensed occupations, from cosmetologists to hairdressers to plumbers to electricians. Is this a way to allow individuals to come into these occupations easily? Is it serving as a barrier to individuals entering middle class occupations? And how does it work? So I've been very fortunate to receive a number of foundation support to really examine how occupational licensing works in the U.S. as well as across a number of other nations.
I'm very interested in that too, and I know a lot of your research relating to COVID has taken place within the U.S., but every country has its own set of lockdown regulations, and I'm wondering if you can speak to that at all. Have you been able to obtain much data in terms of international responses to the pandemic and occupational licensing?
Well, I think other nations. So, for example, I've done work with the European Union and the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development called the OECD. And one of the ways that they have tried to deal with, again, hotspots is to relax some of these occupational licensing restrictions, mainly in the European Union, less so among the OECD countries.
I'm sure that travel restrictions play a large part in that too. Are there any special benefits given to people with occupational licenses to travel across country lines that would otherwise be restricted?
I haven't seen that so far.
Okay. I wonder if that will change in the months to come, because it seems like a lot of countries, especially in Europe, are experiencing more lockdowns now.
Yes, there's again a big spike in COVID cases in Europe, and one of their responses has been to lock down the labor force and lock down the economy, and this has been an issue in terms of how they can get healthcare workers to deal with the growth in the number of cases, hospitalizations, and deaths. All those are key elements in understanding the pandemic.
You mentioned earlier that you've been working with some PhD students. Would you like to talk about the research that you're currently conducting with them?
Always delighted to talk about work with PhD students. We're working on a couple of different areas. One is the evolution and growth of occupational licensing over time and across states, so that policy analysts at the state level and academics can see what influence it's had on the labor market, and also what effect occupational licensing has had on individuals who are ex-offenders. So those individuals are are people who have had problems with the criminal justice system. And if you're trying to enter a licensed occupation, if you have had these issues, you're oftentimes not allowed to enter occupations. So in prisons, individuals may be trained to be barbers or cosmetologists or plumbers. And when they come out, these are all licensed occupations, and when they come out, they find, or the individuals find, that they can't enter these occupations because ex-offenders or ex-felons are not allowed to work in those occupations. So it is a real catch-22 situation in terms of their ability to work in the civilian labor market. And we think, although this is an area we're looking at right now, is what effect it has on recidivism and overall crime rates. I'm fortunate to have three Humphrey students who are PhD students who are working with me at the Minnesota Population Center. And we've been fortunate to get funding to look at the role that occupational licensing has in terms of both its benefits and costs, often called the welfare effects, that is the net of the costs and benefits.
Are you collaborating with any other faculty members or professors at the Humphrey School in your current research?
Yes, still working again on the issue of COVID and individuals who deal directly with patients with Professor Janet Johnson. And I'm also working with Andrew Karsh, who is a professor in the Department of Political Science. And in that area, we're working on the origins and evolution of occupational licensing. That is, what were the characteristics of states that caused them to pass these laws, and how did they evolve? So licensing has gone from relatively few requirements to ratcheting up requirements so that now they've become much more rigorous, and it's much more difficult for individuals to enter these occupations and work in these occupations. So it's limited the ability, especially of low-income individuals who don't have the assets to enter these occupations, to try to get into occupations ranging from cosmetologists and barbers to plumbers and electricians.
That's really interesting. I'm excited to see where that research goes.
Well, stay tuned, and we're working really hard, and very fortunate to be at the Humphrey School that has really supported and encouraged this kind of research over many years. So I'm very fortunate to be at the Humphrey School and the University of Minnesota, and to be in Minnesota that all the opportunities from the Federal Reserve Bank to this great state that is very interested in analyzing and examining in greater depth these important public policy issues.
Well, I know the Humphrey School in return is very happy to have you here. I have one final question for you, which is a little silly, but before we started recording, you mentioned the movie The Truman Show, in which Truman is an insurance salesman. Do you think that he would be able to find a job outside of his bubble when he finally leaves? Because he would probably need to be licensed, correct?
Yes, very good point. That would be a real problem, is the insurance agents require state licensing. So at the end of the show, when he leaves the bubble and enters the real world, he can't take his license with him, because I think it would only apply to people in the Truman Show and not in the real world. So very, very good point. And I guess that would be a great sequel to the really interesting movie, The Truman Show.
Well, I look forward to you being a consultant on it.
I think that given the number of occupations that are currently licensed and the importance of licensing, that could be a whole series of shows to rival maybe even Star Wars.
Oh my goodness, a whole franchise of occupational licensing stories. Well, thank you so much for being with us, Professor Kleiner. And we look forward to seeing where your research goes as the pandemic continues.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, and thank you for inviting me back.
Absolutely.